Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards, like Rob Reilly, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School Podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Art of the Hustle is a production of iHeartRadio. You're listening to The Art of the Hustle, the show that breaks down how some of the world's most fascinating people have hustled and learned their way into achieving great things. I'm your host, Jeff Rosenthal, co-founder of Summit. And in today's episode, I am very excited to chat with my friend, mentor, and, you know, frankly, pillar of culture on which myself and any other event organizer stands on the shoulders of, Michael Lang. Michael is the godfather of the modern music festival. As the co-founder and spirit of the Woodstock Music Festival, which he threw at the age of 24 years old, more than 400,000 people showed up, and it became one of the great moments in music and cultural history. One of the things that really struck me from my conversation with Michael was how he always embraced and was listening to his surroundings, acting and reacting with the given resources that he had in the moment, and doing first and apologizing later. Please enjoy my conversation with Michael Lang. Thank you for being on the podcast, Michael. Really appreciate you being here.
It's my pleasure.
You're such an incredible friend, such an amazing inspiration to me and to, you know, many, many, many people around the world. So honored that you'd join us. Thanks again.
Definitely my pleasure.
So you are in quarantine right outside of Woodstock, New York, on a fair amount of land, but without a lot of people.
Yes. Although a lot of family, which is great.
Which is fantastic. And you've been in this region of the world now for a very long time with your offices in New York and your home out in Woodstock. Did you grow up there?
No, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay. It's in the description. Anyone listening, I am certain knows that you are, you know, one of the founders of Woodstock. You have an amazing body of work over the four decades following. I want to start from where you started. You're in Brooklyn, but I know that you had made your way down to Florida, where your sort of professional story starts. Bring us back there. How old were you?
So, no, this was post-high school. I was at NYU at the time. I think I was probably 19, maybe 20. Basically, the beginning of the third year at NYU. And suddenly realized one day that I really wasn't meant to spend another 2 years in college. There was too much going on in the world that was exciting and just drew me in. So, you know, in what's become typical fashion, I made a career decision and moved to Coconut Grove, Florida, and opened a head shop.
Incredible. And this is mid-60s.
This is mid-60s, yes.
And now when I hear NYU, I think like liberal, countercultural thinking institution. I imagine you were in pursuit of a different lifestyle. What was it like then? What was NYU like then? And then what was the culture like that you were moving to in Coconut Grove?
The culture wasn't really that different. NYU was located in Greenwich Village, and I had a part-time job working in one of the little shops in the village. And
doing what?
Selling crafts and earrings to tourists mostly. And I started smoking pot pretty early in life and did some acid you know, when I was in high school, I think I was 16, I had enrolled in a course in the New School for social research, which was a small apartment on 14th Street. And it was a course that Paul Krasner was teaching called Mickey Mouse to the Green Berets. I became friendly with Paul, and he was making trips up to where Leary was living in upstate New York and coming back with pocketfuls of LSD, which at the time was legal. So that was kind of my introduction. And that was, you know, as is most people's experiences, pretty eye-opening and life-changing. You know, I was at Lafayette High School, and I was pretty bored, and the college advisor, who was a friend of my sister's, as it turned out, she was kind of a legend at the school, called me into his office one day and said, look, you know, you're just wasting your time here, and sent me down to NYU to register for the next term, which was the second half of the year, with the condition that I continue to go to high school at night, get my high school diploma. So that's how I sort of wound up at NYU. As I said, I spent a couple of years there and then realized that I wanted to get out into the world. And I'd been to Coconut Grove for, you know, for a couple of trips down to Florida. And it was just a charming little artist community and very cool and very tropical, actually. It's the only tropical part of Florida. And so decided to just pack up a car with crafts that my friends were making, little stash boxes and pipes and things like that. And I met Peter Max, and we became friends, and he gave me a bunch of posters. And
amazing. Well,
yeah. We became very close friends. You know, he lived in Woodstock also at the time, and I hadn't moved here yet, but he was here. And so we just became, you know, lifelong friends.
So you're in Coconut Grove, you're running a head shop, you know, clearly adventurous. What was the jump to music festivals? How did you transition to, you know, putting on Miami Pop?
So Miami at the time was a very conservative, right-wing sort of place. And the Grove was kind of this oasis in the middle of artists and weird people. So the experience for me was more than just running a shop. It was bringing a certain culture to the Southeast. Of course, music has always been, you know, a big part of my life. And so I started bringing bands to parks to do free concerts, and be-ins were starting to, you know, sort of become a thing. So we had be-ins in the parks. And so I just began that way. We sold the music that we sold in the shop was reflective of the counterculture. And so it became kind of this hub and outpost for the counterculture. People who, you know, when Leary came down, he would always come by. And Abbie Hoffman came down, he would come by. And, you know, musicians that we were friends with, Fred Neil in particular, who was living in the Grove. And I don't know if you're familiar with Fred, but he was, he wrote Everybody's Talking, but he was just an amazing performer, amazing voice, amazing writer. And you know, Joni Mitchell would come down to hang with Fred and Stephen Stills and Crosby. And so that brought that element into our life.
So it was a scene. It like popped off a scene.
It was a scene. And so anyway, so we started bringing music into the mix. And you know, there were just some great characters living there at the time and just remarkable people. And Rick and I became really close friends. And we had seen Monterey Pop together. And we were sitting in my kitchen where most of the inspiration comes. And we said, why don't we do one of those here? Let's do a Miami Pop Festival. So we proceeded to do that. We raised some money from some friends and put in whatever we had. And one of the partners was a guy who owned a club called The Image. His name was Marshall Brevitz. He was involved with the local, I guess, you know, mafia / criminal underground.
Okay.
And one of the conditions of Marshall's investment was he had to get his investment back within 6 weeks. So we set off to do the Miami Pop Festival, and we had 6 weeks to do it. That began a whole different kind of adventure. And this was sort of toward the end of my time in Florida. So I went to New York to do some booking. We had located Gulfstream Park as a place for the festival. It was off season for the races, and it hadn't been raining for a long time. It was drought conditions were coming pretty regularly. And so they agreed. I went up to New York and did the booking. And then we went about just figuring out what a festival was. And so we went to Criteria Recording Studios, which was the big recording studio in Florida, and convinced them to lend us their sound systems.
This is because at this time, you're saying the individual studios had their own sound rigs that would tour with the bands, correct? It wasn't like there was no outdoor festival company to go and rent the sound from, or like, why was that the case?
There was no outdoor company to rent sound from, and we pretty much stripped to studios for our sound equipment.
And what were the stages, you said? The stages were trucks? They were actually trucks?
They were flatbed trucks. We had you know, two sets of two flatbeds side by side, and we had three sets of them so that we could move quickly between changeovers. You know, it was fun trying to figure out what a festival was and how to physically put it together. And I got really lucky with the booking. Hendrix turned out to be our closing headliner because he happened to
Incredible.
Agree that day. And yeah, it was just a lot of things that came together well. And because we were in the middle of this, you know, heavy drought season, we declined to get rain insurance. And the weekend of the festival, unbeknownst to us, on the Friday and Thursday and Friday, the municipality had started seeding the clouds over the Everglades because they were so desperate for rain. And Saturday was beautiful. Sunday was rained out. It was just an incredible experience. The whole thing was just phenomenal.
And it worked as a financial structure. Like, the business of that festival worked out. Nobody came after you for the money 6 weeks later?
It would have worked out better had we not gotten rained out the second day. But
sure.
But we were pretty close to paying everybody off. I think there was, you know, the Criteria was owed some money, but eventually we paid off all the bills, and it wasn't a fortune, luckily for us, but it pretty much took all of our money. So we decided to do some follow-up concerts at a place out on Key Biscayne. There was a floating stage, beautiful setting. So we did two shows. I think we did Ravi Shankar and Steppenwolf, and both got rained out. So by the end of that little run, we decided to sort of pack in our enterprise.
The most famous quote I could find of yours is, "The way to hear music, I think, surrounded by rolling hills and farmlands under a big sky."
Yes.
It's like, you know, it's hard for people in my generation or younger to imagine, but it wasn't like there were these outdoor festivals, music festivals and arts festivals that people went to. This didn't exist. And I was assuming, as we were going to go through this interview and get, you know, into the later, you know, what's also mind-blowing is that Woodstock is less than like 400 days after your first major festival in Miami. But I figured you had like confirmation bias. Like, it just went great. Everything worked. There was no rain. It was perfect. But it sounds like you got kicked in the teeth from the start of your time in this business.
Absolutely. We sort of, we learned, you know, the difficulties and the gods early.
And how long after was Woodstock from these concerts that you were doing in Florida?
It was about a year and a half.
Walk us through this time period. You've done these festivals. You know that this is a muscle that you now have. Take us back. What was going on at this time?
The situation in the Grove had changed a lot, in that a lot of, you know, the old beautiful Grove houses were being torn down, and, you know, high rises were being put up. It was becoming very commercialized. So it was, I felt, time to leave and time to get back up north. And the Grove was a town very much like Woodstock, in that it was a musicians and artists based vibe and small town. Grove especially was kind of a lazy place where I always like to describe it as a place where a dog could poop in the middle of the road all day and not get bothered. So I moved to Woodstock, rented a house, started figuring out how to make a living, I guess.
Were you doing other music projects? Did you open another record shop? And then how did you, what was the origination of, you know, the first meetings where, you know, Woodstock came up as an idea?
I started out actually not doing a music project. There's a town near Woodstock called Kingston, which is a little bit of a bigger community, about 12 or 15,000 people. And there was a Sears and Roebuck in that town, and it was going out of business, and they were tearing down the building. And I happened to pass by and look in one day, and I saw that they were there was this huge pile of ceiling fans, you know, the old wooden bladed kind of ceiling fans. And I asked one of the workmen, what are you doing with those? And he said, nothing, we're going to junk them. And I said, can I give you $5 a piece for them? And bought 200. So I bought 200 of them and managed to get them back to my house and did a little painting and started to sell them to antique stores in the city. And I never hit a shop that didn't want them. It was just amazing.
No way.
Yeah.
You just had an eye for antique wooden ceiling fans, it turned out.
I just knew they were cool. You know what I mean? And they worked. So, and I sold them, I think, for $125 a piece. And that got me through that summer and into the fall. And I was going into the city, and then a friend of mine called, whose name was Don Kider. Don was a vibes player and drummer and had been a partner of mine. He was also an artist in a poster business that we started out of the shop in Coconut Grove. And he called and said, look, I'm in town, formed a new band, and can you just come down so we can talk? And I said, sure. And I came down, and he said, would you be willing to manage us? And I thought, you know, how tough could that be? So I said, sure. And it was a pretty, you know, odd direction. It was kind of a crossover jazz thing that they did, which was just about, was a little early for that, but, you know, it was something to do. And the singer of that band turned out to be Garland Jeffries, and they were called The Train. And I figured, you know, let's see if there's a record company that might be interested in them. And Abby Rader, who was the drummer, DK was playing vibes, and this guy, Abby Rader, was a drummer, said he knew a guy named Artie Kornfeld who worked at Capitol Records. He was vice president of A&R. So we were at a phone booth, and I said, give me a dime. And they gave me a nickel or whatever it was. And I called, and Artie's secretary got on the phone and connected him. And we talked for a few minutes and realized that we were from the same neighborhood. And he'd grown up 10 blocks from where I lived. I said, come on up. And so I did. And walked into his office, and he was sitting cross-legged on his desk smoking a joint, and I thought I was home.
We'll be back with more Art of the Hustle after the break.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenney, Chief Marketing and Growth Officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time with the customers. That is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And how rare was this crossover of like business people that also were like into the smoke joints?
It was just burgeoning in the music business. And we became instant friends and started spending a lot of time. And I was coming into the city at 7 a.m. and going back on the midnight bus.
I'm curious, like how much of this was entrepreneurial? It's like we were starting businesses. We wanted to like make a living. This was an arbitrage opportunity with the fans. How much of it was that versus it's like, this is the way I can pay for my lifestyle, do things I think that are interesting. Were you more interested in the sociology or the culture or the experience of the moment? Or were you already like a entrepreneur in the way that I think of it? Help us get into your mind state a little bit.
I was interested in learning, first of all, you know, something new and in a field that I thought was exciting. And I wasn't really driven by money. I don't think I ever have been. I think it was more of things that fit kind of my view of, you know, what I thought was right and wrong in the world. An art form that I loved, which was music. And I think that those are the things that, you know, motivated me. Also, you know, we were in the midst of trying to make the world over, if we could, and stop a war. And I was very committed to those issues of the day. And so whatever kind of connected all those things are things that I found interesting and motivating. You know, I also kind of realized that, you know, marketing was really a key to anything that you wanted to accomplish. I mean, you know, I was sort of a hippie in some senses, but I was also realistic and was more interested in getting things accomplished than talking about them and dreaming about them. And I realized that, you know, marketing could be a tool for anybody to do anything, whether it's for the public good or whether it's for your own gratification or financial gain or whatever. If you want to realize something, you have to bring other people that involve the public. You have to bring those people into it in a way that gets them excited and committed as it does you. So you really need to commit yourself to whatever it is you're going to do in a complete way so that when you're trying to talk someone about getting involved, they have something to believe in other than just a story.
I interrupted you to ask about the headspace right as you were telling us, you know, how the sort of initial conversation, the initial idea sparked and came into fruition.
So I'm living in Woodstock, and that summer there were these music events called Sound Outs that were put on by a woman named Pam Copeland, who owned a little farm just outside of town. You know, there was a little stage 6 inches off the ground, and it was in a beautiful cornfield, and a lot of the talent was local, but local, you know, then was Richie Havens and NRBQ and, you know, amazing music. It was the kind of place where you'd go and there were maybe 300 people under the stars, smoking a joint, spending the night. And I thought, this is really the way to hear music. This is really the way to experience this glorious nature and music kind of coming together. So that summer I spent, you know, as I said, a lot of time with Artie, and we'd be talking about stuff and ideas and, you know, musical kinds of approaches to business. And I think it evolved in my mind from that experience at the Sound Outs. It also seemed at that time that a lot of what we had been striving for and trying to accomplish with kind of the different social movements that were going on was starting to come apart. And a lot of, you know, this kind of blissful vision of peace and love and a way of living, you know, with each other was coming apart. A lot of the political groups were turning violent, and it was just, you know, things were getting dark, not just in America and around the world as well. Riots in Paris. So my thought was, let's see if we can take this back, stop that kind of motion toward disaster, and take an event out into nature, bring everybody who wanted to come, and see if we could actually make something like that work ourselves. And that was really the kind of foundation for what Woodstock was going to be about.
There are a number of books and movies, countless articles. There's I'm sure a 4-year college worth of time that you can, you know, read about the path that you went on and your partners went on. And all this to say is that at the time, I believe it was essentially the biggest mass gathering ever, 400,000, 500,000 people. Now, here we are 50 years later. In the days leading up, like, what are the things, what are the memories that stick out?
Well, you know, it was kind of troubled as well. I mean, we finally found a location in Wallkill, New York, after looking everywhere. The initial location that I thought we'd have was Winston Farms, which is in a town called Saugerties near Woodstock that fell out early on. We worked at, you know, at the Wallkill site for 3 months and had done all the booking, and everything was kind of in the works, and the town was getting more and more uptight. My two partners, the guy who funded this, John Roberts, and his partner, Joe Rosenman, had made a deal with the Wallkill town council and described what was coming as, you know, wandering minstrels and jazz and folk music on a Sunday afternoon. And as soon as our crews started coming in, you know, and they didn't look like John and Joel, they looked a lot more like me.
Yeah.
People started getting uptight. And then there was something called the CCC, the Concerned Citizens Committee, that started really trying to stop us. And at one point, there were some shots into our barn office, and it was getting pretty ugly. And a month before the festival was to happen, they passed a local law, local law number one, which made it basically impossible for us to continue there. I mean, one of the things about Woodstock that stays with me is that there were things moving that were beyond our own energy or my own energy. It just had to be. I mean, you know, as I said, we spent months looking for a site and then had to settle for something that was really not ideal. And the day after we got kicked out of Wallkill, I had taken half of my staff and got them to start packing. The other half I put on the phones to start calling radio stations and newspapers and just putting out a call. And the day afterwards, we received a call from this guy, Elliot Tiber, who had a motel, kind of the motel from hell in White Lake, New York, and said he had a festival permit and a site and we want you and come on up. So we did. We went zooming up there, and we, myself and my head of operations, Mel Lawrence, and met Elliot in his hotel, which looked like the hotel from hell. I mean, none of the rooms had doors on them. There were things crawling out of the swimming pool. It was turned out to have been his parents' place, and he was trying to help him save it. And then he walked us down into the field, which was mostly underwater. And so I had to stop Mel from killing him. But we had passed some beautiful places on the way, and I asked if he knew a realtor that could take us around and show us some of the things, and he did. We went riding through the countryside and came over this hill and on Heard Road, and there it was, you know, this perfect place for us. You know, that was kind of miraculous. Just things like that that you would think would just be so against the odds kept us alive.
And I just picture you in the car cruising in the countryside there. And it really warms my heart because you're kind of like, for me, the first like bohemian capitalists. You know, it's like, yeah, here you are using, you know, the system in a sense to achieve this incredible art project almost, right?
Yeah.
And an Aquarian exposition was the tagline or the theme or the vision. What did that mean to you then?
Well, you know, I mean, the Aquarian exposition was just something that reflected the age of Aquarius, which was about enlightenment. And we were hoping that this festival would be, you know, a path to enlighten people about a different way to be together. it was called the Music and Arts Festival because it was really to be a celebration of all the arts. So not just music. And we had a whole inner city from the ghettos around the Northeast, bringing artists up from the ghettos. And we had Native American artists that we flew in from New Mexico. And we brought a group called the Hog Farm, which was a commune out in New Mexico as well, to help the vibe and also to help people set up their campsites, because we realized people were not, for the most part, used to living out under the stars for any period of time, especially right. People from cities. And it just taught me, you know, so much about commitment and about possibility. You know, time is always, can always be either your friend or your enemy in things. And, you know, much as in Sun Tzu, The Art of War, you know, time can really be an ally. So you have to stay committed beyond what's right in front of you and sort of see a bigger picture, a wider screen about possibility and how to get things done.
Were there artists that were there? Were there people that you saw perform that, you know, you still to this day can feel?
Well, Sly, certainly.
Yeah.
Was mind-bending. I'd seen him a lot, actually, during the course of that year.
Why for you?
Because he really created a whole genre of music. You know, without Sly, there's no Prince, I don't know, he just sort of, his music and his words just called to me somehow. And his performance at the festival was mind-boggling. I mean, he created this sort of giant church with, you know, he'd call out to the audience and 500,000 people would respond. It was just amazing. There were several amazing moments. You know, the most famous, I guess, is Hendrix's rendition of the national anthem.
Where were you standing?
I was standing toward the back of the stage.
Were you paying attention? Were you watching and experiencing, or were you organizing and producing at that moment?
I was working until he went into that song, and then everybody stopped. You know, it was just such a perfect capture of what was going on in our lives.
As you're producing it and you're seeing it working, you also knew that it was not going to be a financial success, right? Like, as you're on the stage, as you guys are producing this, you knew that you were going to have to dig out of this thing, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when Friday rolled around and our ticket booths weren't in place, we knew that financially this was not happening.
But it seems like you are able to both recognize that and compartmentalize that. Was that naivete at the time, or were you just like so happy with the result, the feeling, the vibe, the happening that it occurred? Like, take us a little bit into your psychology at that moment.
You know, one thing that I've always kind of had a natural knack for is compartmentalizing things and putting them in their own little safes or boxes, so that they don't really sort of spill over into other things and other decisions and other energies. And, you know, to me, you know, having it happen was always the motivator, there it was happening. So there was nothing we could do about it. You know, people were suggesting pass a basket around and all these, you know, kind of crazy ideas which I knew, you know, were ridiculous. And so it was just, this is, you know, let's realize what everybody else here has realized already. This is free. So let's go make the announcement.
Art of the Hustle will be right back after this short break.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenny, Chief Marketing and Growth Officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time
with the customers, that is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Obviously, there was immediate cultural resonance from the event itself. And
yes,
you know, I want to know from what you remember, like, what were the newspapers saying? How did it feel to you? And then the follow-on effect, you had this like year or two afterwards where, you know, the country changed so much and this thing sort of like made its way into the canon of our culture of that time. Walk us through it a little bit. Take us back.
I mean, the film is really kind of what brought Woodstock to the rest of the world. You know, I always felt that Wadley did an amazing job of really sort of giving the audience a good picture of the experience and what it was like. And we were, you know, getting letters and calls from people all over the world that were just, you know, so ecstatic to have been a part of it, even through the film, which I get, you know, and because it resonated with what else was going on at the time in the, you know, in the counterculture and with young people around the world. So we're kind of at the end of the festival, we're four kids or four people in early to mid 20s. John Roberts, who is just a wonderful person and who was really put up the funding for the festival. He had an inheritance, which was pretty sizable, and he just wrote all the checks. But his family, from the very beginning, thought it was, you know, horrible that John would even become involved with a project like this. Loud music, and, you know, it was that kind of family that it came from. So they kind of came in and took over. We were in debt about $1.2 million at the end of the festival. And Artie and I went to Warner Brothers because we knew that the film was, you know, could have redeemed everything that we had lost, plus, you know, quite a bit. And so we went to them for an advance to try and take the partnership out of its problem. And I think, I don't know if this is actually what happened, but it was apparent to us that John's family had already spoken to them and agreed to sell the interest in the film back to them. Or most of it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So unfortunately, that's kind of the way it went. It was a disappointment, but I wasn't really affected by that. I had gotten so much out of it, and mm-hmm. it had confirmed so much about what I was hoping
Like what?
You know, just the way that people related to each other that weekend. And, you know, all the things that we had grown up with in the 60s about brothers and sisters and sharing and human rights and civil rights and all of those things, all of those struggles, you know, if you were there that weekend, those were all resolved. None of those kinds of issues were present. I mean, there was no discrimination. There was no fighting. There was only understanding and bonding. It was an example of what's possible, how the world could work.
And you said it. You said Woodstock is the beginning, and it was a new culture and a new generation functioning on its own, and it works, and it will continue to work in the cities, and it proves that it can happen. Tell us, like, where is that? Where did the movement go? Do you see it today? Have you felt that feeling in other places that you've visited over the last 40 years? And I'm also curious why we haven't seen more of these sovereign experiences where people can, you know, kind of enter an altered state of communion and community.
First of all, I think you can't construct that kind of experience. I mean, it's got to, you can create a space for it and conditions that are favorable for it, but you can't program it. So after the festival, of course, we thought the world was going to be different the next day, and then reality strikes and you know, people go back into their lives and the changes are much more subtle than they were on the weekend. But nonetheless, it did filter into society. Things did become more liberal. To me, you know, one of those moments was, I think it was in the book, that when Obama was inaugurated, it was kind of one of those Woodstock moments. I mean, I think somebody in the New York Times called it Washington's Woodstock. It's just those moments when there's actual, when it's not something you describe, it's something that you experience. When it's not, you know, just rhetoric, it's rooted. Those are special moments that just have to come together almost spiritually.
What brings you pride? Because you're not a proud guy. Like, that's not one of the adjectives or superlatives that I would use to describe your personality. In fact, you're incredibly humble. You know, like the first time I remember getting to meet you and I was like, oh my God, like you built Woodstock. How did you do it? It's so incredible. And you're like, well, first we built a stage, you know, and it's like, and you've always wanted to shave down the pedestal. You've always wanted to empower people through your story. But what does make you proud when you think about, you know, the legacy of Woodstock, when you think about its effects on society, where do you see its fingerprints that really make you happy?
Pride's kind of an odd word, you know, for me to describe. It brings me pleasure. It brings me happiness. It brings me faith in humanity. It brings confidence and possibility for us to evolve, you know, along a spiritual path. So the Woodstock experience was, for me, confirmation of those things, of possibility. And that's something I cherish.
In your career since, you know, literally 40 years ago, you've produced numerous festivals and managed other artists and built all manner of different entrepreneurial businesses. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that you've also had some major challenges with organizing Woodstock 50 and, you know, with both the positive and negative of 99.
Yep.
Not to dive into the blocking and tackling of, like, you know, prescribing the issues, but I do want to know, for you, you know, like, you've lived a lot of life. You've, you know, gone down the path enough times to where I imagine some of the wisdom that you have for us, you know, entrepreneurs that want to have, you know, an impact with our work. What are some of the things that have come up for you, or the lessons that you've continued to learn later into your career?
Well, you know, 99 is a good example of reflection of a certain mood and a certain time. It was a time when the youth culture was kind of angry, and so it was reflected in the bands of the day that were popular. And I learned, I guess, that you can't force something to happen against its nature. And in a way, because of the way 99 was booked, first of all, the bands that were happening at that moment and were popular at that moment, that no matter what your intentions are, what's going to carry through is really what underlies a certain time in history in a certain culture. And you can't really fight against that. You know, Coachella, for example, embraces the Los Angeles culture. You know, that's great marketing and that's great insight. But, you know, that's why when we decided to do this 50th anniversary, it was not really about trying to recreate a Woodstock moment so much as to highlight what I think is the biggest threat to the planet, which is global warming. And that was what that was about. And that was its reason to be. Not so much, you know, about trying to recreate a spiritual Woodstock moment, but more to bring people into that discussion because it's something that's fundamental to everybody's life. And I think that to me, you know, 99 really was a lesson about that, about what what's the right path to follow when you're trying to put together sort of a mass public event.
You have children that are teenagers.
Yes.
You have children in their 40s.
Yes.
And you have friends like me in our 30s, and you have friends that are your age. You have this really, really wide set of inputs, of trusted inputs. Do we romanticize the revolutionary attitude of the 60s? Do we misinterpret it in some way? Talk to us about what are we misremembering? What do we need to understand more about the 60s? And what are the parallels for today?
I think it is, you know, sort of romanticized somewhat in, you know, looking back at the 60s. But, you know, I think it's just recognizing kind of what's possible at any particular moment. Take, for example, your efforts with Summit and the idea behind Summit. You know, that's only possible because of a more responsible way to approach entrepreneurship and business with an awareness of the environment that we live in and a planet that we have to respect and care for. And I think your timing was perfect in that there was this sort of burgeoning awareness among some entrepreneurs that this was an important way to approach business and life. And I think that, you know, you took that spark and really fanned it into a flame, which encouraged more people to take that perspective on business and career. And I think that, you know, it's a constantly evolving world and possibility is something that continues to occur every day, every year, every decade. And recognizing what is possible and then, you know, applying intelligence and commitment to encourage it.
What can we lean into? What can we do to do right by your legacy? We all love the work that, you know, resulted from your efforts. What would make you happy to see more of in the world?
I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm such a fan of what you guys are doing. You want to talk about pride? I'm very proud of all of you guys because I think that what you're doing is really a sea change.
And the listeners, talk to me about what the listeners can do. How can we continue to represent the work? Stay focused, stay committed.
Stay focused, stay committed, you know? Stay kind and connected to, you know, your brothers and sisters in the human race. I mean, that's really the bottom line here is that we're all part of this experience together. There is no, you know, there shouldn't be, I should say, any walls put up between people and ideas. You know, if you approach things with gratitude and kindness and compassion in everything you do, the world would be a much better place and hopefully we'll get there.
Well, thank you, Michael, for joining us on the podcast. Thank you for listening.
Pleasure, Jeff.
This has been The Art of the Hustle. You're the man. Thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, Jeff.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards. like Rob Riley, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.